call the meeting to order.
House Bill 63.
Taking testimony today on House Bill 63, we have a whole bunch of information in front of you. So we'll hear from the department first. You want to sit up at the end of the table? Give us your name for the record and who you're representing. At the end of the table, one orange chair is pulled up.
All right.
Well, we might want to vote Mr. Elias and vote.
We don't want to play the vote.
My name is Dick Wilson, and I'm the Director of the Division of Public Assistance. As Director of Division of Public Assistance, under my purview also comes the operation of the Medicaid program and Medicare program in our state. This particular bill speaks to the question of guardianship. On our position paper, I might refer you to the position paper. I don't know if you have it in front of you. This short position paper, one page specific.
Yes, we do.
Okay. What we're talking about here is the need for guardianship, for the establishment of an office of guardianship within our internal review section. The internal review organization is headed by Roger Lang, who's not under my direction, but is head of the sort of auditing function that we have within within our department. The idea being that in nursing homes and hospitals across the state, we have a problem sometimes with intermixing of funds. That is, that patients quite often, when they come into a nursing home or a facility, have a certain amount of money that's theirs, and they have money coming in at different times from relatives, etc.
Mr. Chairman, may I intercede with a question?
Mr. Brown.
I have no problem at all with hearing the witnesses saying, no, I think we should. I think it's the first time it's been before the committee, the time I knew it was. I may have been here only by alone before or something, but I'm looking at the cover letter, and there's a reference in the letter by the governor with the original bill before it went through Hess and so forth. And this is the first time this committee has seen all this, but I guess it's been a lot of rigorous work in him. That refers apparently to bills that attempt to do the same thing in the ninth. At least we've got three members who were also in the ninth. And if you could just refresh our memory as to what that, if you were at all involved in that or testifying on bills, what, did they pass the House and not pass the Senate, or just die in the House, or what?
At the time that was introduced, I was not in my current position.
Okay, well, maybe if there's later on, if there's another witness who could remind us of that, that would help me.
I think I could provide another witness and really speak from a historical perspective.
Okay.
To go on with my testimony, it appears that we have in the room with us today also members of the Hospital Association who are here that may want to speak to the individual problems in some of their facilities. But it appears that what is happening practically is that when the patient has certain funds available to them, sometimes they're incapacitated and are not able to function in a manner to say that they want the funds that come to them privately used for their various and sundry things that they use up, like toothpaste, toothbrushes, and things like that that they may need. It's apparent that the people running the various institutions would prefer not to be held responsible and accountable for those funds. And they can speak to, I'm sure someone from the Hospital Association can speak to the problems involved in handling the funds in the respective organizations. What we're looking for is the development of an office of guardianship, which would be responsible for policing the use of the of those funds and to make sure basically that those funds are used for that individual for which they were intended. I'm sure the Hospital Association group can speak to the problem involved in the use of those funds within their facility. What happens quite often is, my understanding, and someone from the Hospital Association can correct me if I'm giving misinformation here, but it's my understanding that in many instances money will come in that's earmarked for a particular patient. And because of accounting practices, it's difficult to make sure that that money actually goes to that patient. Is that correct? Can anyone from the Hospital Association help me out with that question?
I could speak to that, but in opposition, I don't think it's difficult at all. We have a small...
Who are you, sir?
Brian Cohen from Cordova Hospital, Cordova. But I'd like to address that in separate testimony, if I could. Hold on.
Sure.
What I'm saying in my testimony is that if it's the pleasure of if it's the pleasure of the legislature that this operation become an existing operation within the governmental stratum, it would be necessary for the fiscal note which you have in front of you. It would be necessary to have this number of people. We're talking about a clerk typist and a guardianship administrator. These two people would be reporting directly to Roger Lang in his organization. That's why, if you'll notice, the fiscal note was prepared by Roger Lang. I signed it for Roger to prove that I had looked at the fiscal note and agree that those are the people that would be necessary in order to administer this program. I have along with me today Richard Hacker from our department, and also Dr. Chalmers, who reports to me in the utilization review. Dr. Chalmers, do you have anything you wanted to add to my testimony?
Not at the present
time.
Any
other
questions,
Committee
members? Mr.
President. I'm sorry that I'm not as up to date on this bill as I should have been. I haven't had a chance to review the information until we started this afternoon. The office of the guardianship administrator would be personal to a public guardian being appointed, or is that necessary even if we don't adopt this amendment having to do with public guardians?
I'm not sure. Dr. Chalmers, could you answer that question? We're talking about...
Well, we have a problem currently with the guardianship role. I mean, both our own department and also the nursing home. And we have had discussions with the Attorney General's office last year on how to resolve it. We did have a meeting similar to this when the Hospital Association was down last March, and unfortunately it wasn't possible to put things together during that current session of the legislature. So really this is, after a lot of effort that's been put in, the request is raised about where the guardianship role and office should be best located. We do have an attorney in our division who would be perhaps more helpful than either Mr. Wilson or myself from a legalistic standpoint. But we'd be more comfortable if we had some help. And so with the nursing homes, I believe, from what I've heard.
So that the fiscal note applies to the bill whether or not we adopt the amendment that's behind the position paper here.
Is there any other questions?
I'm just trying to figure out what I've got in my file. It turned out I had about six copies of the same amendment with different cover letters proposed by different people, and just spare two extra copies of the bill that look different and weren't. So as we go through, people might comment on what we're supposed to have in the package. And is this is supposed to be in the package too, with the House Committee report?
Because they have an amendment.
Right? Yeah, it's back here. It's under that. But apparently the Freer-Harris amendment of last year is the same as the Helen Byrne amendment of this year. Okay. Of which we have. We've got lots of scratch paper here, if you'd like to.
Do you have prepared any kind of sectional analysis of the bill? Looking at the bill, I see several sections that relate to seemingly to things besides the setting up the Office of Guardianship and stuff. There's, you know, amendments to a lot of existing statutes that look fairly technical and stuff, and neither the testimony or the position paper really, you know, go to each one of these sections.
To clarify, the position paper that was prepared by my office spoke basically to the amendment. It didn't speak to the total bill. Now the bill, it's my understanding, there was a position paper looking at various sections that was prepared by the Division of Mental Health. Dr. Schrader would be the person that would be able to speak.
I'm Jim Price from the Division of Mental Health. I can probably speak to what you
need there. Okay. Yeah, you'd like to. Okay. My question was whether you had a written sectional analysis.
I can give you a summary of the bill that would help. But the bill, section by section type summary.
Well, that's what I'd like.
Yeah.
Do we have to hear it orally, or
I'd rather have it in.
This is just a two paragraph summary. It just briefly describes what the bill does.
Okay, I think we know what to do. But I was interested in whoever had drafted up the bill as to why For instance, on section one of the bill, why did it say or other developmental disability? Why was that the definition of incapacitated person, you know? And that's one of our purposes, to look over all these sections and make sure they're drafted correctly and why all these changes in existing law are made and what they do. So I guess we'd like to request a written analysis of each, you know, that speaks to the purpose of each section of the bill and why particular sections were drafted. I think we understand, you know, what the general purpose of the bill is. Seems
no problem.
Okay.
If you're interested in why we
Yeah, I see you got the main portions of the bill as their section, you know, starts on section two that sets up the guardianship and the procedure for court appointment. And on through about page five, then starting in page five, section eight, you start, there's a whole series of amendments to various sections of existing law, different definitions, you know, some deletions of existing law. And we'd just like to know why all those changes were required.
I believe we can find the original draft of the changes. I believe it was Mr. Chairman.
Well, the Attorney General's office.
Somebody, Attorney General's office, either Peterson or somebody. We can find out why that language was placed in there.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question along that line. If you can make notes of an inquiry, so I
need to direct there.
Some of this, at least, could be considered to be changing court procedure, and that there are things in here like the court shall set a date for a hearing and so forth. And if that's the case, the question is, are we amending a court rule with regard to any of those matters? And if we are, of course, then we have to add a section with regard to the effect of changing a court rule, what court rule it is, so if the House knows it has to vote by a two-thirds vote. Now, maybe the Attorney General will say those sections don't have the effect with regard to procedure, but only substance. But that's another question I'd like to have.
Mrs.
Rapp?
Doing general things. This is in my file. I haven't had a chance to
That's
look.
The same thing I just ran
it's
into.
Exactly
it's just the same bill. For some reason, people thought we had a bill.
The official printed version.
Okay, it's the same as
there.
The...
Yes,
okay. Well, I'm just trying to pull things out to figure out what we're dealing with.
Sorry, I didn't get this thing sorted out. Okay, is there any other questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Next, we have Mr. Brian Saylor.
My name is Brian Saylor. I'm the administrator of Cordova Hospital, small hospital. I just reviewed this a few minutes ago myself and had some problems with it, although I'm not really sure what they mean. Okay, so I'll just share my concern. I'm confused.
I assume you didn't fly down here just to testify in this building.
No, I did.
It was nice of you to come by.
I think we were being as nasty as we are to bureaucrats, we would do something like pointing out that it was introduced on the 17th of January, 1977, and also ask you whether or not the lobbyist for the Alaska Hospital Association has worked on the bill at all.
But since we're not nasty...
We're not nasty, so we won't ask you those questions. We only do that to stay in place.
I don't know. This is the first time that I've been aware of the bill. But perhaps it's because I haven't been paying attention to it.
Don't worry, we don't look at all these bills either.
Obviously, none of us have ever seen it before.
1,500 bills, and somebody, look, House Bill 333.
Go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
On page 8, it talks to section 13, which I understand is the section that sets up a separate state agency for the administration of any sort of guardianship program. I'm not really familiar, just as you're not, with all its implications, but I have some thoughts on it. What may happen is that the state takes the responsibility then for, on behalf of the incapacitated person, signing checks, keeping accounts. That's one of the principal, I guess, concerns, that public monies end up funneling through to the patient. With a small hospital, we only have 8 nursing beds, and occasionally we get people in there who can't fend for themselves. To give you an example of the problem that we may face if the state took over this function, I don't know if they will or not, but if they did, Social Security comes in and accrues to the patient. There is no problem with accounting of those funds. We deposit it in the patient's account, and as the administrator, I can sign on behalf of that patient when they either want cash or we have to dispose of funds. I think the problem is or maybe that somehow or other people don't feel that administrators or the facilities which are providing direct care would do this honestly, or there could be a conflict of interest. I can see that. Of course, there would be. If my facility needed money and I could go milk somebody's account, well, I wouldn't do it, but I could see as it would be an option. But that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. There would be a lot of problems that I would see in making the funds readily available. As the Social Security money is added to the patient's account, it has to be kept at a minimum. Otherwise, the patient has enough money in the account so that they don't qualify for Social Security. Sometimes, when a payment comes in, I guess if we were on top of it all the time, we would know precisely when that date would come. But if you end up over the amount, you put the patient's status in jeopardy, or that's what we've been told. So what we do is to purchase things on the patient's behalf. Now, whether or not that is quite kosher or not is a decision that you'll have to make. But say, for example, somebody's account has to be depleted and they are incapacitated, we will, in their best interest, buy them a new hospital bed if they have an old bed, if we know that they're going to be there for a long time. Or we can buy them a personal article or something like that. The way we normally do it is to go to the patient, explain as best we can what the funds will be used for. The patient many times doesn't really know what's going on. We have an assessment of the patient's needs from the nursing staff to work with. The patient acknowledges his approval of that suggestion or his disapproval. We live with that. We take the money out of the bank if he approves and we buy the piece of whatever it is.
May I assume that that's when you're in the role of, under the existing language of the section you referred to, you're under the role of an institution who has been appointed guardian? You just do that informally anyway, even when somebody else is in fact the guardian?
We do it both ways. Actually, we work signing checks for the legal guardian of the patient in some instances, and we do it informally as co-signatures on a savings account in other cases. But apparently this bill, or if I'm clear on it, would make sure that no public or private agency that is providing direct care to the incapacitated person may do this anymore. And what that would do would make a very cumbersome situation that could be correcting a non-existent problem.
Do you feel there is any problem from your point of view?
Not from my point of view. I don't have... This is only a small institution speaking. I don't find any problems with it as it exists. I see that there would be problems in the solutions that are being proposed.
Mr. Chairman, what the witness is testifying to is basically saying that somebody can be both judge and jury with regard to this matter without any other input. It may be that there are no abuses known in Cordova at a hospital or something. The idea of turning over to a private agency funds for somebody and having them decide when they're going to spend further funds that have been accrued to their own income, something that bothers me very much and can be read that that would be the case from the section of current law. It's like somebody being a trustee and also having some close dealings with the subject of the trust and having an apparent conflict of interest and not being at all worried about the apparent conflict of interest.
Yeah,
you know, the trustee dealing with the trust funds and then makes a decision that the major portion of the trust funds just happens to invest in a business that he owns all of or something like that. It's the same kind of conflict. At least I think the section of the bill is an attempt to address that. Maybe it's clumsy or something.
I see, Representative Brown, that you're right. There is a conflict of interest, and it's the balance between the possibility of someone taking advantage of that conflict versus the extra cost of government and the decrease in administrative efficiency or local decision making. And that balance, I think, is what's claimed. For a small hospital's point of view, I would say that if you take the options away from the hospital, that you've lost rather than gained. There is a conflict of interest, but I see the balance going the other way.
Was it second cut, for instance, in your case, your institution more money? I mean, it'd be something that if this responsibility were taken away from you, and as this bill proposes, state agencies. set up to sign the checks and be the guardian, then that would just mean somebody else would be doing it.
Yeah, it'd be more of a hassle. It wouldn't cost us anything. It wouldn't save us anything.
Well, I think under the section that's proposed to be amended, that person need not be a state agency, but could, for instance, be a kind of a generalized guardian, one person appointed for this purpose with regard to several guardianships, somebody who is in Cordova, but yet does not have the same interest or financial interest as the Cordova Hospital. And, you know, and I suppose it would go to the wisdom of the court in who would be appointed guardian in that situation. And I also suppose that the hospital would have a position and standing before the court to make the kind of arguments that you're making about who should be appointed as guardian. Perhaps it shouldn't be a state agency at all, but a responsible private individual that doesn't have the same interests as the institution in Cordova. Wouldn't that solve most of the problems you've talked about?
Yeah.
So you've talked about it as only a state agency, but the section says either.
That's true. If you could, I guess the only thing that I'm speaking in favor of is efficient local decision making, where somehow or other the patient's financial standing is put in jeopardy, and if it had to go through a state bureaucracy, I think there may be some problems. If it were handled at a local level, I think that'd be great. That'd be fine.
Just a question so I can get back to what funds have we talked about? I lost that earlier. When we talked about funds that we're going to buy the hospital bed, what funds are we talking about? Any checks coming to the patient?
I'd assume that you can help out on the next time. I'd assume that they were coming from a variety of sources. Social Security pays money to patients, and that money is deposited in bank accounts. In some cases, family could give money, and that's deposited in the same account. So it's from a variety of sources.
But if you see that the family provides so much, and that might endanger his Social Security payment, you buy a hospital bed out of that, so it'll be lower enough so he'll be qualified for Social Security or some special payment.
If the patient agrees, we tell the patient what's happening. That the money in the bank is beginning to get them to a limit that would disqualify them from further payment. Somehow or other, money has to be disposed of.
There's a great deal of trust that we have to put in the fact that there's not somebody that, you know, I've been serving all against your hospital, but nursing homes and other things might come under this. We would just leave it up to the family, send them all kind of money, they could just buy stuff for the home, maybe beyond the cost of care, if they wanted to. There's just something about this that doesn't sound like, while it might, I'm sure it's being done, if we do anything, it's the best way out. There's something about the whole thing that sounds like it's not normally good business practice to handle this, even though it's expedient.
Yeah.
And I understand where you're coming from, but I'm thinking the hospital, nursing homes, and other places that it might not be, quite frankly, one that I'd want to trust that much with all the patient's money to buy whatever they think is appropriate for the patient. I think that leaves quite a gate here. I kind of like, Brandon, what if under this provision, as long as it's someone who doesn't provide that care in Cordova, appointed by the court, I'd feel a little safer with that type of protection for the patient.
Mr. Brown keeps sitting next to me saying, something bothers me about this, something bothers me about it a little bit too, and that is, aside from the issues that have already been raised, Mr. Saylor talks about talking to the patient, explaining to them, and if they agree, doing it. But in fact, what we're talking about in this bill is incapacitated people, and that means people who lack sufficient understanding or capacity to make or communicate responsible decisions concerning themselves. So that's a different situation, I think.
From time to time, the administration of the hospital has made decisions on behalf of people that are just so incapacitated they have no idea. And you're right, there's no control other than the good faith of the provider, which isn't an awful lot to go on.
Mr. Wilson,
did
you want to? I think what we have here is a perfect example of what happens many times when the provider community is concerned about the red tape of the bureaucracy. I think what we have is the provider community asking the bureaucracy to cut the red tape. And what happens quite often when this request is made is the bureaucracy responds with, yes, we'll cut the red tape, and then they cut it lengthwise. And I think that's what we've got here. We are saying that from from the bureaucracy's point of view, that not that we want to, that we're saying that the providers are not straightforward, honest people. What we're saying is that by providing this type of relationship of a guardianship role that is controlled by the bureaucracy, we are actually allowing the nursing home industry and the hospital industry to be clean from any chance of anyone pointing the finger at them and saying there's a possibility of fraud. And you know, this is the way I look at it, that we're actually in this situation, by developing a guardianship role within our bureaucracy, we're saying that we're able to better protect people and make sure that the money that actually comes to them is used for their own personal use.
I wonder what the witness would think if, for instance, as a pathway attempt to address some of the problems he's raised, if after this section we were simply to add another sentence, making it clear that where a practicable report would should appoint a guardian who is actually present personally or through a representative in the local area where the care is being provided. So somebody in Cordova doesn't have to worry about a state agency with a representative in Anchorage or conceivably under the bill, even though it'd be pretty silly to do it, a private person in Fairbanks or something like that.
Do you have any further comments?
No, thanks.
Thank you very much. Betsy Howe.
My name is Betsy Howe, and my job title is nursing home advocate. I work for the Older Persons Action Group in Anchorage. Basically, I'd like to address the same concerns that Mr. Sarah was talking about, but from the point of view that I am to advocate for the civil rights of a client, and until they are deemed incompetent, they are competent adults. One of the concerns is that a person not only has to have their financial dealings handled in some way to avoid the cost overruns and the savings to take them off of Medicaid, but also decisions about where they're placed, where they're cared for, what kind of medical care they receive, also concerns about if they're to be moved when they're admitted, people have to sign saying they have received their civil rights. This person is incompetent and has no guardian, then how are we to assure that they're receiving their civil rights and understand them? So one thing that I'm very supportive of in House Bill 63 is that we very quickly identify the people who need guardians and go through the legal process, find some way to channel the cost of that legal process. Many times it's the case that a person doesn't have the option of a family member or a concerned citizen in their area to take on that role, and I think that's why my understanding of why the amendment was attached to this bill to request that a state official play that role. I'm also very supportive of the idea that somebody working for that official on a local level take on that advocacy or guardianship role. If we place it in the hands of somebody in Juneau or in Anchorage, are we actually providing a guardian who cares about that person and understands that if they need medical emergency medical treatment, can that person really respond to the guardian? So I think we need to be addressing those items if it's going to be placed in a state office. But it doesn't just reflect on the financial needs of this client. Many things by Medicaid mandate say that it has to be addressed by the client or the guardian, and very often there is a void. The client is not competent and there is no guardian. I feel very strongly that right now I don't think there is a guardian by any of the administrators, but they have no legal recourse. They're functioning in a void. If somebody wanted to sue them for a misappropriation of funds, they have nothing to fall back on, and I think that's a terrible position to put the administrators in, who are, I think, with all good intentions, trying to provide for the people that they have, and yet the conflict of interest is there very definitely. How can you say that you're purchasing an item for the best intentions of this client with nothing to fall back on? Really, that's a very poor position to be putting administrators in, and I think this bill will serve their needs as well as the client.
Questions?
Yes, you talked about the
possibility of an emergency medical situation, I suppose. Let me see if I understand what you're referring to. Are you talking about a situation where if the person were competent, then they would be requested to fill out a form and they would be allowed to be submitted to surgery or something? And since they're not competent, then their guardian must do that, and then who does it is everything. Well, Mr. Chairman, I suppose that would be another example of a good reason to put a provision in this bill making it clear that the person who is designated as guardian be available on the in the local area. Same sort of thing that we just talked to Mr. Saber about.
In section 13 there, if you read it, the court points guardian that what you have there in section B and 918 page 8 is a priority list of who gets appointed as the guardian. And the fact that we're adding a public and private agency to be a guardian, they're still number 6. The court has to go down that list and as a last resort make it number 6.
Now, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
It may be that the current law is difficult and doing it this way wouldn't be enough. Suppose the court is then stuck with the availability of the spouse because the spouse is asking for it, but the spouse lives in Quailiok and the person's in Carriage North in Fairbanks. Then the kind of thing we're talking about with regard to who is able to quickly provide a yes or no answer to the care facility, really that's not addressed.
Well, I assume the person would be qualified.
Well, think about that one for a while.
Okay, is there other questions? Thank you. Rosalind Reeder.
My name is Rosalind Reeder, and I'm administrator of Lemoore Healthcare Center in Anchorage. And just as a little brief history for some of you, as a state employee, I worked on this bill. And last year, this bill was written up. Position papers were taken, and at the same time last year when the Hospital Association was here, we did request hearings on the bill. However, it was tabled at that time, and there was no further action on it. Action was delayed on it, but we were not able to get any further response to the bill. We would like to encourage that it be passed. Personally, as an administrator, I see it as a very important need for the patient, as well as for my own protection and for that of my employees. It will protect patient rights. It is a safeguard of their money, and it is a protection against any misuse of those money. It not only protects the patient from misuse from the employees, the administration, or their own family. I have a situation right now where I have a family that is trying to drain off my patient's money for inappropriate expenditures, and they can convince that patient that he should give them everything that he gets every month to their benefit, to help with their rent and their expenses and living in the community, to the point where he may have nothing left. So he can be abused not only by also by his family. We have a very sophisticated accounting system whereby there are many checks and balances, and administratively there is no way that those monies can be misused or misappropriated. The patient signs the requisition form saying, I need to have a new website, or I need to have some new clothes. And that requisition comes into the office. Checks are made out for their expenditure, and they receive that which they have. Sometimes they will request things that are inappropriate for themselves. It's kind of hard to, yes, get a CB radio for a patient who is a quadriplegic in the hospital and unable to use a CB radio. But again, he has his right and his choice to those purchases. The section 13 that has already been addressed speaks of the public or the private agency, and at one time it was considered that the public administrator would be that guardian, and I don't know whether that is still being considered in the department's position paper, but that was what was
the who would be next?
The public administrator, coroner's office.
Set up under the uniform probate. So actually they've submitted a proposed amendment that would create what do they call it? Another position to do that, and not the public.
Guardianship.
Is that what it is? Public guardianship.
Well, the any individual who is unable to act in his own behalf, and sometimes it takes a judgment on the part of the individual, and it requires a medical definition of what that's a person's incapacity and his inability to act on his own behalf. He may be able to communicate with you and I verbally, but his judgment and his ability to make sound decisions are not always there. So it means that one must determine that. And if a doctor has medically determined that a patient is mentally or physically unable to act on his own behalf, then from that point on, we have to find someone who can act for that person. And many times it's very difficult. If you have individuals living in the state of Alaska who have absolutely no family and no friends, they die, they need money, they need possessions, and there is just no place that we can go other than to the coroner's office and go into a potter's grave. And it's important that they have the right to have someone speak for what should happen to them, not only in this life, but
questions from the committee members. What's the situation at the present? I'm a little not too up to date on this, but what would happen right now if I were to go to one of these and I was up here by myself? And how would you determine if I wasn't able to make these decisions for myself? What's required? Just one doctor saying that he doesn't think so? And then you can, if the state automatically is taking over my finances on what one doctor said, is there any hearing or anything, or am I missing?
Okay, the doctor can say you are no longer able to function mentally.
All right. What happens then?
That's where it stands, unless someone petitions the court to appoint a guardian or someone to act in your
behalf. Well, then who does take care of it?
At the present time, it's in the hands of my social worker or contact with another state agency to see that a court hearing is held.
Well, they do have a court hearing.
You can petition.
But if you don't have one, can the social worker decide what to do with and make decisions?
It may be necessary to do that. In fact, you know, the doctor may have to assume the responsibility. If I had a patient who was hemorrhaging, say you were to have a sudden hemorrhage, you know, a decision must be made as to whether we should try and save your life or and take you to surgery or wait till we find someone who can answer to that, and it may not be a matter of time.
And the doctor won't make that decision.
Yes, he would go ahead and make the decision.
Will it? I thought maybe they wouldn't unless they had the guardian or somebody take it.
Well, they don't enjoy it.
They don't
think it's subject to liability.
Right. Malpractice.
They'd be subject. They're really between a rock and a hard place.
Sure.
If they don't do it, then they're subject to liability also.
Does this bill solve that problem?
It would solve it in that you would have someone to speak in your behalf.
Does this bill require that all incapacitated people have a court appointed guardian?
Yes. And there's another bill, House Bill 519, which also speaks to this.
Could you point out to me the bill where it does it? Because I was looking, but I couldn't find it. And it talks about how you do it, but it doesn't say. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Would you restate that, please?
Well, what I wondered is if the bill requires that every incapacitated person have a guardian appointed.
Chairman, it would seem not, if you look at Section 12.
That
says, if an incapacitated person has no guardian, an emergency exists, the court may exercise the power.
Okay, so that if you don't require it, then, as you said, it's up to somebody to petition. Now, maybe if we set up a state public guardian, then they could go around petitioning when they hear about people or something, but I don't know how you quite get to the point of, okay, Ed goes into the institution, and who figures out that he should have a guardian appointed.
That's what I
mean. Yeah, right. And if there's no requirement, then it can just keep happening like it is now. There's not really a court-appointed guardian.
Well, it's very difficult for us because we have to go through the maze of government agencies and going to someone who would petition, maybe using the patient's money to get an attorney or go to the last legal services.
Why do you have to do that if the current law?
Someone has to do it. In other words, someone has to initiate it.
Why do you have to?
Well, you don't have to, but
that's
for your own protection, that's what you have to do.
And that's the problem. That is, at least theoretically, under the law, somebody could be incapacitated and be certified by a doctor even after the passage of this bill. And then if no one chose in his behalf to seek a petition in the court, or to put a petition in the court to seek the appointment of a guardian, there would be none now or after the passage of this bill. And the only reason that people do now, apparently, are partially to protect themselves from some possibly theoretical future liability for something or other. That bothers me a little bit.
I don't know that you'd want to go so far as to have the law say that every incapacitated person shall have a guardian, because there may be incapacitated people who are with their family or in their home or something, and at least in terms of people in a public or private institution. Maybe there should be, you know, it should be formalized as who is the guardian, whether, you know, even if you want it to be the institution, but at least ought to be somebody rather than just...
Several years ago, while living in Fairbanks, we had a young girl, age 22, who had to have a sudden emergency operation, and she was living in the home of her parents. And when they went to the hospital to sign for that, the parent was not able to sign for the surgery because she was not her legal guardian. She did not have any right to sign for her. The girl with cerebral palsy was unable to sign for herself.
Why?
Why? Because she was an adult. She was a free consenting adult by the law.
Oh, okay, because that wide range of ages. Right. For some purposes, you're an infant, when you're, for other purposes, an adult. Okay. We're ranging over ages 16 to 19, you're right.
In Alaska, an incapacitated person means any person who is impaired by reason of mental illness, mental deficiency, physical illness or disability, advanced age, chronic use of drugs, chronic intoxication, or other cause except minority to the extent that he lacks sufficient understanding or capacity to make or communicate responsible decisions concerning his person. And that's Alaska Statute 1326.005.
Is there any other questions from committee members?
Well, Mr. Taylor, how fast would this take effect?
Normal.
No, I mean 90 days after the government. No, not the bill itself. I'm talking about that. This bill, this person who's going to have to do all this stuff. Would that take care of an emergency situation where somebody showed up at the hospital? It's not going to solve the guardian situation or who's going to sign for an operation. This bill won't have anything to do with that one.
House Bill 519 is
pointing
for that, too. No, this one, if we had a guardian...
What you gave, ma'am, were about if this girl shows up and no one's there to sign for it, you weren't necessarily testifying for this building in that respect. This wouldn't do that, would it?
It would help if we could have a guardian established, a guardian ad litem, someone who could act in behalf of the person. That's where the public minister is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have some other questions? Okay, we need two things. We need one thing. We need a sexual analysis. Provide us with. I guess I, for one, would like to at least consider possibly an amendment that would provide that incapacitated people in an institution, I mean, if we're going to pass this bill, that there be a requirement that there be a finding by the court, and they go through the process described both in the existing statute and here. If we're going to, it seems like if you don't do this, this bill may or may not have any meaning.
You mean the requirement?
Yeah, because we set up a public guardian, and then there's got to be some mechanism for him to find out. I suppose we could run around all the institutions, get the list, and decide that somebody's not on the list, and then
wander down the halls and look for people that aren't accounted for somehow.
Right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with you, but the example that was given of the young elderly who lived in the home and whose parents could not sign because she was an adult. Also ought to be taken into consideration. I mean, it shouldn't be just people in institutions, but maybe adult, incapacitated adults.
The only reason I just wasn't immediately in favor of that is I don't know the extent of what you have incapacitated persons being cared for by in private homes. I don't know how much you'd get into. You might get into a whole area that might be a lot of ramifications.
I think we have to get into it, Mr. Chairman. I don't think it's too much of a problem because there you just clarify a matter that some probably, because of the priorities in the bill, a judge would end up appointing somebody who is in that private home, just as somebody who is known to have the legal authority to do something in the event something comes up.
The Convention House of 519 will speak to that developmentally disabled person, and the governor's plan, the institutional safety plan for all developmentally disabled persons, urges them to keep people at home if at all possible, not in an institution. And so the whole front that is being put forth in the state is to keep as many at home as possible. But where those persons cannot stay in the drain on the family, as such that they can no longer care for a patient in a home, then they do go into the institution. And if those patient parents can maintain that guardianship of that individual, but if they get older and die, there should be someone still acting on behalf of that person. So there are quite a few in the state.
reflect the amendment also? This fiscal note speaks basically to the fiscal note that was prepared by my office speaks only to that. Okay. Well, the fiscal note for the entire bill any different? Being one town, I guess they have to fly around a lot. Everybody will have to call in, whatever. Maybe it would be better to contract if the state wants to provide the service, to contract with somebody locally in maybe not every community in Alaska, but with some one of the other state agencies and court system or somebody else, so that the service was available locally. Because you're only proposing to hire one person in a sector, and I assume they'll be sitting in one town. And either way, spend a lot of money traveling and a lot of telephone bills. So maybe you could consider that idea.
We also have the office of aging,
Sure, basically that is, and the question I've got is, can they support, if they would, maybe on paper or in our next meeting, the argument that there should be created a special commission for the guardian as opposed to 20 and 60. And then also, maybe at the next meeting, I think it would be helpful to have reading over our shoulders, whichever assistant attorney general is involved in drafting the bill, so I think we'll probably have some more legal points raised.
Well, I think much of the testimony went to the amendment they were department.
Does anyone see any need for some? It seems like an awful lot of those here on the fee. That's why the scale of money is a lot of payment. We'll take the millionaire and we can't make the same thing. This is going to be much higher than the guy that's doesn't have it. Or I'm taking care of it and I'm appointed as an administrator for somebody. And he's absolutely a derelict, has nothing. What kind of fee? Should there be something in here that is not to exceed or not to exceed so much an hour? Some kind of a billing form.
It certainly sounds like the state doing the same thing we're talking about the private guys doing.
This would be you charge him so much a month for being the guardian. Is that what's envisioned here?
Can you come up with something here or something not to exceed or something? Some protection against the guardian is taken under
that. That's not an artfully drafted section.
No.
Anyway, maybe somebody
will prevent private fraud and encourage public fraud.
This is what you do, Ed. You charge, if you're trying to break even, you got 285 people at $70,000 a year, this one, $150 a piece or something.
Okay.
All right. Do it again.
Information they wanted, and I'm Bob, so I'll pass you out a packet of information.
Mr. Chairman, I've looked over those materials and it seems to just further back up what we already heard in the committee. I've got to go to council at 3:30. I'd like to move the bill.
Okay, well, I think that there was some talk about some of the amendments on the bill. We had some problem with the definition of who was the full time. The court system says that they think it's impossible to do so, to define what a full time nurse is. So I guess that if we leave this like this, they're going to have to figure it out anyway. Legislative Board of Retirement Benefits Analysis and Recommendation, which is $279,000.
And also, they're presuming to be a standing committee of the legislature taking a position on the bill. Yes, I heard it wrong.
So, Bob, you know, was this, they didn't prepare the system, or they just endorsed it? There's at least no disagreement. We haven't received anything from the court system disputing with that system. Does anybody then have any questions or proposed amendments? Move the bill.
Judge, I haven't had time to read all this stuff. What's going on?
Mr.
Lassen.
Mr. Chairman, I thought we brought the question up last time we had a hearing, whether or not this would fall within the Salary Commission's prerogatives. What
did
we establish on that?
Anything? They said it doesn't.
Where's it short?
Here. It's in your packet. It's a letter from the salary.
Yeah, from Kate Deagle. It says, in answer to your question, Council 7.7 does not appear to conflict with the Salary Commission since the compensation and benefits for magistrates are not under our review.
Where is that?
It's in that packet information. It's a letter from Kate Deagle.
From who?
Kate Deagle's chairman of the last Salary Commission.
Oh, there it is.
He was saying that basically there would have to be parallel revision of some aspect of Title 22.
What is G that he's saying there on the field?
Well, G is right there. See, this bill proposes to amend 22-2501-G. And he says, just repeal it totally. And then put in a new definition. Instead of just amending, he just wants to amend it in a different way and define justice in the Supreme Court justice and judgments. Just define it in a different way. He's proposing a redraft of Section 1.
Is there any problem with the rest of Title 22 there? With regard to defining a judge to include a full-time magistrate for purposes other than retirement? Well, I suppose if there had been, he would have said something like that.
I mean, in other words, if we define a magistrate as a judge,
it says for the purposes of this chapter. Well, let's see.
Well,
chapter 25 yeah. Only on retirement?
Retirement and death benefits.
Oh, okay.
So it only affects this one?
Then that's not a problem.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of other questions. I'm just trying very quickly to read this letter from Susan Burke. Of course, I understand that they think that no magistrate should be included in the existing judicial retirement system, and I gather that this letter is vague because of that conviction on their part. In other words, if they wanted it, they would come up with better definitions for it. But the fact is, I wouldn't feel comfortable about passing this bill out of the committee until we had a clear understanding with the court system and said exactly what does a full-time magistrate mean, and should this apply. I'm assuming that what they're saying is that this should apply to all magistrates, whether full or part-time, despite the fact that the bill says full-time. And I'd also like to have a fiscal note. I don't think we have one yet. Oh, yeah, it's here.
$279,000.
I
prepared
that
thank you. Okay. Hold on a second. Lisa, you read in the second paragraph of the letter, it says, those who were required to keep regular office hours at 8 o'clock to 4:30 were considered full-time for purpose of applying leave benefits under AS 39.20. So I assume that's how they would define full-time magistrates. People don't work, a 40-hour week. I guess nobody works.
There's something else in the letter that
I think that is... would be a reasonable way to define.
But, down in the fourth paragraph, it says, after having some time to reflect on your request for a definition of full-time magistrate that might be used in House Bill 727, we find that it's impossible to do so. Now, that's just ridiculous.
Yes.
But I wouldn't feel comfortable until we've reached some kind of an agreement exactly what it is.
Well, what she's saying is that she probably doesn't want to write into the statute, the magistrate is a person who works every day from 8 o'clock to 4:30, but it doesn't matter.
Well, they don't want to help us with the bill because they're against the bill.
I understand that, but I don't see any reason why we couldn't do some kind of an agreement.
Is that what you want to testify on, some fiscal note?
That was proposed.
Okay, who are you representing?
I'm the director of the Division of Retirement Benefits from the Department of Administration.
Well, let's sit up there on the table and we'll hear from you. Please identify yourself, Director.
My name is Paul Arnold. I'm the Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And I think the Alaska court system has already testified on the bill in opposition. And while I'm not testifying from the standpoint that they have taken, I do understand the problem they have with the term full-time magistrate, because magistrates are covered under the public employees retirement system. And the same problem we ran into with full-time versus part-time as far as the definition for these magistrates. At that time, the law had to be changed to say a magistrate would be covered and given full-time credit. It does build in a certain amount of inequity by doing that, because in essence you have somebody working part-time receiving full-time credit. But I think the arguments that Susan Burke has presented are good arguments, in the sense that the idea of the retirement system is to attract and retain qualified people. And she's already stating that they do not have a problem attracting and retaining magistrates. But be that as it may, our position on the bill would be very grave concern with the fact that we have a retirement system, the judicial retirement system, that is not funded. By that I mean it's a pay-as-you-go system, such that when benefits come due in that particular year to pay a retiree, a certain amount of money is appropriated to pay those benefits. Well, the problem is that you accrue liabilities over many, many years until it comes time to pay the benefits, so you're not really recognizing your liabilities. And this has been a problem extensively throughout the lower 48. Prime example is in New York, where their pension programs got so out of control it brought them to their knees. Same thing, I'm not saying that the same thing is possible here, but in no way are we recognizing the costs of the judicial retirement system. Now, the legislative board, which has reviewed this, which I'm a member, an ex officio member, their concern was primarily that they're adding people with full-time magistrates or whatever group to a retirement system that's not funded. The answer being, why add a liability to a system of which you have not recognized your liability in the first place and are not funding that system? So they're very adamantly opposed to any modifications to the judicial retirement system unless that system first is funded, so that then you can recognize your liabilities. The court system now is appropriating about $370,000 is a rough number, $370,000 in a year to pay benefits. However, on a funded basis, they should be appropriating about $1,800,000. So what that's meaning is the curve is going like this, and X number of years out, instead of being appropriating something that approaches a level or a moderately inclining amount of money, it's going to take an exponential increase because the funding is just not there. So I think my testimony is that obviously, any system that's not funded, I think the administration has made it rather clear that they oppose any retirement system that's not placed on a funded basis, and consequently, any addition to that unfunded system, such as adding magistrates, would also be opposed.
So basically, you're saying you're opposed to the existing judicial retirement system, and you're also opposed to expanding it anymore?
We're opposed to the fact that it's not funded.
Okay.
In line with the...
Okay, is this the administration's position?
Yes. In line with that, the same with your, I guess, Legislative Board of Retirement Benefits is also opposed to it. If you look back, the Salary Commission has looked at the whole concept of benefits for judges, and they felt that there's no problem having a judicial retirement system as long as that judicial retirement system's benefits were brought in line to what is being granted under the PERS system. There's just absolutely no comparison at all between the benefits granted under the PERS system as those granted under the judicial system. There are many, many times more better benefits under the judicial system, to the point where the legislative board even has come out very, in the discussions rather vehemently, that these benefits have got to be reviewed and brought under control. And the first step was to get it funded. The second step is to review the benefits. The second step was to make the system contributory, which it isn't. And the third step is to bring the benefit levels under control. And the reason they oppose that adding anybody to the judicial system is that under the Constitution, two things cannot happen. The benefit cannot be taken away once granted, and two, the judicial salaries, which are constitutionally guaranteed against diminishment, can't be lowered as, in fact, what happened if you made it contributory. In essence, you're taking part of your contributions away and putting into the retirement system. So that, putting all these together, this is, I think, why the court system has their reason for opposing. I think the administration has its reason.
This is right.
What do you mean by funded?
Well,
you say it's not funded.
Funded as opposed to unfunded or pay-as-you-go. A funded system recognizes your liabilities, past liabilities and future liabilities. And it says that even though you're not going to have to pay it out, physically pay the retiree today, you're going to have to pay a retiree 20 years from now when he retires, you're going to set monies aside today so that when the benefit comes due that you have the money set aside to pay those benefits.
You're talking about contributory versus non-contributory?
No, I'm talking about funded versus non-funded.
It doesn't matter whether it's contributory or not.
Right.
As long as you put the money in, it's funded for the future.
Right. What you do is you actuarially determine the contribution rate that's necessary to support the benefits, to support the liabilities that are going to come due. And then today and all future employees will pay those benefits. So in essence, what you do, you say that the time frame in which the benefit is earned, the monies are set aside.
And that's not true of the judicial retirement. We do not set aside money each year. We appropriate money to pay the actual benefits. Is that all we do each year?
That's correct. And that was why I said that you're appropriating about $370,000 or $380,000 to pay the benefits, as opposed to about $1.8 million to put it in that in 1 year, put it on a funded basis, and that would continue on.
You mean if we appropriated $1.8 million, that would fund it for the foreseeable future? Is that what you're
from
saying?
That, and then your next year you'll put about another $1.8 million plus a percent increase for salaries, $1.8 million, $1.9 million, $1.10 million, something like $1.9 million, $2 million. We're put very differently. The system
so
is very.
So what you're saying is that as it's going now, all of a sudden there's going to be a tremendous upsurge in the amount we're going to have to appropriate each year. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Put it differently, right now to fund that system, you'll have to pay 109%. 109% of the judicial salary today to fund it. So if you pay that judge $30,000, maybe that's been $33,000 or $34,000 today, just to fund the system.
They live a long time.
What?
They live a long time.
They're
sedentary. Do you have any questions from the committee? Do you have anything good?
No, only that I can get a plug in. There are two bills, Senate Bill 90 and Senate Bill 91, that do make that system contributory and funded.
What are the bill. Senate bills?
Yes.
Okay. This is the wrong place to plug. Do you have a definition then that you use a full-time magistrate?
No, I do not. In preparing the fiscal note...
well, how do you guys, you're just like the court system, come in and tell us that we can't do something and then you're doing it anyway, and then but you don't have a definition for it?
Well. The answer to that is that all magistrates now are currently under the PERS system, and by law they're granted full credit, so there is no distinction for full-time or part-time. Under this system, you're calling out...
Somebody works a day a month, they're full-time?
I think what happens is they don't necessarily, and you're getting me out of my area, I think the court system should address this, but my understanding is you may have a particular magistrate who's working, quote, full-time, and then a couple months later, because of a caseload or something, hits to something like a part-time. Well, they look at this ups and down thing, and they put him in three classes, as I understand, and that's for paid statuses only. They recognize that it may change very quickly, so you don't really have a position established as full-time or part-time or some other level.
But you take them all, regardless of what class they're in, for a benefit.
Yeah, 16 out of
50. Under the PERS system, we do, and the only reason we're doing that is because statutorily, that's the way it was established. As far as preparing this fiscal note, the term full-time, you know, I knew it meant something, so I had to really apply my own definition. And I looked basically at their salaries and tried to come up with a cutoff and try to find it somewhat of a reasonable break in that salary structure and said, okay, anything over $15,000, I'll consider full-time, anything less than $15,000, I'll consider part-time.
That's
and it was very arbitrary, but it was the best I could come up with as an identified stolen assumptions.
Okay, so that was what you used for definition, was anything over 15,000.
That's correct. I think there was something like 16 out of 42 or 16 out of 50. I think that's identified also in the fiscal note that fell in that category. Quite obviously, if the term is defined either more permissive or whatever, that the cost will go up.
Any other questions? Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. What is your relationship to the legislative board?
As director, I'm one of the members, ex officio member because of my position.
If the chairman would allow a little latitude.
Sure.
What was your understanding of the board's function in commenting on a bill? It come here in the form of do pass or do not pass and so forth. It's raised this question in our House session today.
Well, the legislation that created the Legislative Board of Retirement Benefits is not very clear other than it addressed the areas that the fiscal impact should be reviewed and recommendations should be made. The board, when they got together, the new appointees plus myself and the commissioner administration, had several discussions or discussed what role and in what form the board should take. And first to start off, the board would make a recommendation as a board in total, but then we got to the point where we were starting to add minority opinions, if you will. And then it finally fell into why not, it was suggested by Ken Humphreys, why not take something like the any committee does, where you have a pass, do not pass, no recommendation. So we tried that and felt that in any area that at least some statement should be made as how the board finally concluded what they concluded in their recommendation, such that do not pass because, and then for these reasons. And if somebody felt strongly that they wanted to express their minority opinion, that it would be stated. So it was sort of an evolutionary process that came about. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Right. Mr. Arnold, does it follow that since we're increasing the liability of the judicial retirement system under this bill, we're decreasing the PPRS liability? Is there any minus factor you would put into the fiscal note because of that?
Yes, there could be a factor placed in there. It is not placed in there.
Could you give me a ballpark guess about how much money is there? They are now contributing to PPRS, right? And the state is contributing also.
The magistrates are contributing 4.25%, and the state is contributing 11.56%, so they just kind of adding up 15 or 16%.
What would happen to...
I'm just trying to draw a comparison. I think I can very quickly draw that. So it's about... It's about 16% as compared to 70%, so what is that?
16% of what now?
16% of salary on an ongoing basis to fund the benefits. That
under
PPRS. Right, that under the PERS. You can compare that roughly, and I mean very, very roughly, this is a rough numbers, to about 70% of payroll if you were to put those same magistrates under the judicial system.
Now, under the 16%, some of that comes out of the salary and some is contributed by the state, is that correct?
That's correct.
Whereas the 70% would be entirely contributed by the state.
That's correct.
And what would happen to the money that they have put into PERS now? Some magistrates may have been to the state for some years. Would there just, there is no provision in the bill that they can transfer the PERS time that they put in or anything to the judicial retirement? Is there any correlation between the two?
Yes, what the bill says is those who have retired under PERS stay under PERS.
Uh-huh.
Those who have not retired, the amount contributed by the full-time magistrate towards retirement under 3935, which is PERS, shall be refunded to them. And then any amount contributed to the retirement to PERS by the state shall go back to the general fund. So there'd be two refunds made to the magistrates of his contributions and from the state to the state, really from the fund back to the general fund for the employer portion. And then the full-time magistrate and the judicial system, that's that all their past service plus all future service would be free.
Oh, I see. All they would fall under, all their past service would be free instead of, I see. That, I don't see that here, but maybe it is here without my knowing. Okay, let's accept that is the case. Then all that money is refunded to the general fund. Does that do any damage to the PERS system or would it be a large amount? I mean,
no.
That money would just fund the liability that would occur if those people retired under PERS, so there's no damage to PERS.
That's correct.
Thank you for your testimony. We have a couple minutes
to recess. Mr. Gerben, as representing the Magistrates Association, the full-time magistrates, we'd certainly like to have something to say in the county, Mr. Arnold, and some of the questions about full-time versus half-time or less.
Well, shouldn't even let him testify, especially since he's from the administration. We already had a hearing on this if they showed up. And I don't really, I intend to be in favor of the bill, but
at some point I'm going to stop the hearing because we have a bunch of other people who came in here to take testimony from them because they've come all the way down here. So if we're going to have further consideration of the bill, it won't be possible to have it today.
Well,
so,
the only problem is Representative Ludd says, Mr. Arnold says he can't understand the difference between full-time and half-time, and there's been an order of that.
We'll have a recess for a few minutes. Good news for some, bad news for others. It seems that we don't have a quorum here to move the bill out, so we're going to have to postpone further consideration of House Bill 727 this time. So we will switch over to House Bill 63. House Bill 419. House Bill 419. 63. So we'll be back to let you know when we have to end.
And which number are we going to take up? What number is
House 419. House Bill 419.
419. I'm just going to tell them all about it, right? I hope. I almost think I'm up to date on this, and then I forget what you told me about it.
Besides Punch Kleinkopf, Art Holmberg, Peggy Bird, who want to testify on House Bill 419. Okay, House Bill 419 is a bill that we introduced last year because it was a portion of the Children's Code that had some amount of controversy over it. So rather than hold up the whole thing, we took it out and passed the rest of the Children's Code. So we have had this before the committee for some time and did hear a lot of testimony on it last year, both pro and con. Although we didn't decide what to do with it. So, would you like to testify first?
My name is Cecilia Kleinkopf, and I'm here representing the Alaska chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. I should also let the committee know that I was a member of the Children's Code Task Force. From its inception, so have that perspective on this particular bill as well. I represented the National Association of Social Workers on that task force. Our position on the bill really is neither strong for or against, but rather we would like to propose your consideration of some changes in the bill. The position of the Alaska chapter of the National Association of Social Workers is that any adoption of statutes should clearly and completely protect the legal rights of both the natural parent, the child to be adopted, and the adoptive parent. To that end, we believe that the relinquishment by a natural parent of their child for adoption is clearly the most advantageous way for that child to be legally free for adoption. We believe that termination proceedings most surely protect the legal rights of everyone involved subsequently in an adoption. Trying to give full recognition, however, to Eskimo adoptions, which are traditional and cultural to that group, we do understand the use of the consent form to adoption. And we certainly do not object to the use of a consent form in adoption. We do, however, have difficulty with the wording in the bill before you, preferring the original language recommended by the Children's Code Task Force.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, what section are you talking about?
Well, I was going to go at it section by section in just a moment. It is the belief of our members that, and our research included reference to the standards from the Child Welfare League of America, who has served as a consultant to the legislature in past years, some of you may recall. And from their recommendations, which I have as well available and can read to you, the consent to adoption is most beneficially used only in those instances where the adoptive parent and the parent, the natural parent, are known to each other. For instance, in Eskimo adoptions, where the natural parent and adoptive parent usually are known to each other. For that reason, we believe that a consent form should name the adopting parent. Where anonymity is desired or desirable for purposes of protecting the identity either of the natural relinquishing parent or the adoptive parent, in those cases, the relinquishment of parental rights is a preferable legal activity. And that position is also established by the Child Welfare League of America. So just with those preliminaries in mind, I will
Which version of the bill are you on the one that's...
Sponsor substitute for H. Bill 419. That's the correct version, is it not? I will give the committee members the brief position of the Alaska chapter. Then I also have with me the original, or the recommended version from the Children's Code Task Force. For the particular section, which is the version that we prefer. First, however, it occurs to us in looking over the whole bill that there might be some benefit to taking section 11, which occurs on page 5 of the bill, and moving it to the beginning of the bill. Now, not being a bill drafter, I'm not well aware of what the implications of that might be for the different order of the statutes, but it seemed to us that if Section 11 were first in the bill, it would state clearly in the statutes the three methods which are by which parental-child relationships can be terminated, and that that ought to perhaps precede the other parts of the bill, since it seems to us to make the bill much clearer. So that would be a recommendation that we would have if it's possible, and we didn't know what the ramifications of that might be. Then in Section 2, how consent is executed. The Children's Code Task Force language for section, that particular section, was the required consent to adoption shall specifically name the adoptive persons, and may be executed at any time after the birth of the child in the presence of the court or in the presence of a person authorized to take acknowledgement. So that language stood in the original version instead of the language between line 13 and line 19 in the version of sponsor substitute that you have before you. We prefer the original version, since we believe that if the consent is to be utilized, it should be utilized where the parties are known to each other. That would satisfactorily enable traditional Eskimo adoptions to continue to take place and to use the consent form. They are known to each other.
Could you give me the line number?
The language from the work draft copy, and I can give the committee a copy of that following.
Is that just for subsection A?
Yes, subsection A. In the sponsor substitute, it would be preferable language for lines 13 to 19. The remainder of that section stayed the same in both versions of the bill, the one before you and the original Children's Code Task Force recommendation. And we're comfortable with the remainder of that section.
What is the difference in this? What's the result of that?
The result, as members of the committee might be aware, there are a number of what are referred to as private adoptions taking place in the state of Alaska. We are one of only about three or four states remaining which even legally permit private adoptions to take place. They are against the law in most states in the United States. We are very concerned that what seems to be occurring is that using a consent form which does not name the adoptive parent, individuals are taking children and placing them for adoption, having obtained an unnamed consent form from the natural parent. In other words, a doctor, a lawyer, a nurse, a minister may I know a girl who is pregnant and wishes to give her child up for adoption. May know also of a prospective adoptive couple for that child. What is done then is the girl does not relinquish. Rather, the individual, adopter, let's say, has her sign a consent form that names baby Jane, and her may know also of a prospective adoptive couple for that child. What is done then is the girl does not relinquish. Rather, the individual, adopter, let's say, has her sign a consent form that names baby Jane and her signature as the natural parent, but does not name an adoptive parent. Then the doctor takes the infant, places it with the couple whom he knows. They immediately proceed to petition the court for adoption. The consent form just stays quietly until the adoption petition is heard, in which case the consent form then is taken out of the drawer, the name is filled in, and it is filed with the petition for adoption. The concern we have with that is that the legal rights of the child are not clearly protected under those instances. Whether or not the natural parent knows it, that child is still her child. Her parental rights to that child have not been terminated. Therefore, she may go away thinking she has, in essence, relinquished her child for adoption, but indeed she has not. Therefore, our concern is with the possibility that the adoption will be unsatisfactory, will not take place. We've known of instances where a couple has got a divorce before the adoption is actually consummated. In that case, that child remains legally the child of the natural parent. She has not relinquished that child for adoption. So we are concerned about it from two points of view. One, that the use of unnamed consents continues to further the private placement of children. And second, we are concerned because of the vague status of the child's legal rights in the interim between when an unnamed consent is used and when an adoption is completed. So that is our reasoning behind recommending to the committee the original language from the Children's Code Council. Do you wish me to wait to see if there are questions on each section, or should I just need to
just go ahead?
Raise
your hand.
Okay, in section 4 on page 2, we would simply ask the committee's attention to that section. At your request, Representative Gardner, last week about 8 individuals in Anchorage sat down together and tried to take a look at this bill, representing Cook Inlet Native Association, Catholic Social Services, the social workers in the community. Some people were able to come, or were invited to the meeting, were not able to come. But the chairman of the board of directors of Catholic Social Services in Anchorage is an attorney, and directed our attention to section 4. None of us was aware of the fact that since this bill was originally drafted, there has been a Supreme Court decision, I believe he said based upon a Georgia case, which now has established that a putative father who has never established a relationship with an illegitimate child does not need to be notified of a pending adoption. Now, not being an attorney, I may not be interpreting exactly what he said correctly, but he referred to a Supreme Court decision that has come about after the writing of this bill, which, to his mind, would probably make it wise simply to delete Section 4. And so we have no real recommendation on that section, but would call it to the committee's attention. And if we understand correctly his explanation of that case, it would not seem necessary to amend 2015-100 in this way. Okay, then on to section 6 on page 3. As the committee is probably well aware, legislation passed last year, which speaks also to section 6 in this bill, adoption assistance. There was an adoption assistance bill passed in the legislature last year.